tweet at TodaySOR.
And I see the figures are just in from Spain. Its latest coronavirus statistics, the death toll there has risen to just over 10,000, 10,003 this morning from 9,053 yesterday. That's, in other words, 950 people have died in Spain from coronavirus in the last 24 hours. Obviously, different countries reacting and responding in different ways to this pandemic. Let's hear some of those world leaders.
A quarter of the world's population is now living under some form of lockdown due to coronavirus.
I was at a hospital the other night where there were actually a few coronavirus patients and I shook hands with everybody, you'll be pleased to know, and I continue to shake hands.
Angela Merkel, about to announce the most severe restrictions on freedom of movement seen in Germany since World War II.
But there is one country whose president remains in denial about the dangers of COVID-19. Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, who insists governments should prioritize the economy.
The virus is there. We're going to have to face it like men, not like children. We're going to face the virus with the reality of life. We're all going to die someday.
The new law allows Orbán's government to rule by decree without parliament's approval. It sets prison terms of up to 5 years for those convicted of spreading false information about the outbreak.
And you should be saying congratulations instead of asking a really snarky question. You should be saying congratulations to the men and women who have done this job, who have inherited a broken testing system and who have made it great.
So leaders responding in different ways to the pressures of the crisis. On the line now are Shona Murray, Europe correspondent with Euronews, and Anton Savage, PR consultant with the Communications Clinic. Anton, we'll start with the person who's provided the most bullish response to the coronavirus, Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil. He has suggested that the information he has spread about the virus was seen as misleading. Twitter, in fact, deleted two of his tweets in recent days.
Yeah, this is a remarkable thing. You now have social media giants policing the language of at least quasi-elected presidents, which is something we never thought would end up happening. It's also probably not the president we'd hoped they'd start with, but nonetheless, it does show a shift from Twitter, at least, to a need to make sure that some level of factual accuracy is maintained. What they took down was videos of him saying that, you know, this whole social distancing thing, meh, how important is it? And also touting the wonders of hydroxychloroquine, which is the synthetic quinine, which is, as you know, Donald Trump's favorite medicine for dealing with the coronavirus, and led to the person in, I think it was Arizona, trying to find their own version of it and managing to poison themselves.
Yeah, we'll come back to Trump in a minute or two. Shona, Viktor Orban in Hungary has basically made his own parliament obsolete.
Yes, well, he's part of that cohort of strongmen like Bolsonaro there, Trump, Duterte. So it wasn't entirely surprising. In fact, it was quite predictable that he passed this legislation, which is imposing a state of emergency, no parliamentary oversight. It'll be indefinite. It means he can rule by decree, by essentially orders from himself. It's also, as I said, it's indefinite, and actually Hungary has been in a state of emergency since 2015. So we're right to be fearful that, you know, he's not going to end this when the coronavirus emergency ends. There's also prison sentences for journalists who are found to spread so-called fake news. But in actual fact, the media is very much under the thumb of Viktor Orban. So it's really much more than just a state of emergency. It's Viktor Orban finally, I suppose, putting a nail in the coffin of democracy in Hungary. And because people probably know at this stage, he's been chipping away at Hungarian democracy and institutions for about 10 years. He's hollowed out the judiciary. He's changed the curriculum in Hungary as well. And to little or no sort of, implementation when it comes to the EU or the likes of Fine Gael or the parties in Brussels.
Yeah, the European People's Party. Meanwhile, in Russia, Anton, Vladimir Putin, there's a sense that perhaps this crisis might curtail his plans to be president for life, or on the other hand, might it make it that bit easier for him?
Well, this is it. Like Shauna said about Viktor Orban, the same is true with Vladimir Putin. He has been busily chipping away now for several decades to get himself in a position where he can be prime minister or president for life, depending on which title best suits him, but it maintains being the same job. He was getting closer to passing legislation that would remove term limits and allow him to be in for, I think, something to the order of the next 10 to 15 years. There is one school of thought that says, to some extent, Russian dissatisfaction with the way coronavirus is being handled may undermine that. But there's a phrase from a predecessor of Vladimir Putin's, which I think he would be aware of, which was from Joseph Stalin about, I think now 70 years ago, said, 30,000 soldiers killed in a war is a statistic. One child drowned in a pond is a tragedy. And one of the things that Vladimir Putin has a genius for is finding the singular anecdote, the singular photo shoot, the singular action that shows him to be the strong man in command and distracts from the giant vague numbers of awfulness that may be going on outside the door.
And Shauna, in the United States, we see Donald Trump hosting these daily briefings. He has certainly changed. He's done a complete cartwheel in his approach to the coronavirus crisis. His numbers seem to have been going up. But I mean, if the Washington Post headline that I was alluding to earlier about the US heading for an Italian style level of engagement with coronavirus, it could surely scupper his chances of re-election.
I mean, I think that's the least of anyone's worries. I mean, he was actually warned by the Biodefense Preparedness Team in 2018 that a pandemic was America's number one health security threat. And last year, under John Bolton, the National Security Council advisor, they actually disbanded that team. He's also, as we know, over the past few weeks, said that the coronavirus was a Democrats hoax, a media hoax. He said everybody was going to get tested when we know there is a huge problem, a global shortage in testing kits. You know, he's actually done everything to attack journalists who've been asking very basic questions about how is it dealing with this crisis. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, we saw maybe in the last 2 days, on Tuesday, he was acting a bit normal. He looked a bit flummoxed that finally the seriousness of the situation is actually taking fold. And he said, you know, OK, America's going to suffer some really dark days. And the best case scenario is 240,000 people dead. And that's the best case scenario when we know that the health system in the United States is deeply unequal. So let's see what happens in November. I think obviously the most important priority is dealing with the threat at hand.
Yeah, and Anton, New York is not a country, but it's really at the centre of all of this in the United States. 391 deaths in New York State yesterday. But if it were a country, the suggestion is Andrew Cuomo, the governor, would be leading the global fight against COVID-19.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you put that's where America is interesting in its total numbers, because one of the things that the governor of New York has recently said is he said, look, this is coming for you. What we are seeing in New York, you are going to see across the rest of the nation. And don't think that because you are a rural area, this won't affect you. Look at upstate New York. That's a rural area, and we have COVID ripping through it. If you take just a statistical analysis of it, New York is now the fourth most affected country, were it a country. There's actually more cases in New York than are reported in China. Now, some of China's numbers may be off, but it gives you the scale of how bad the problem is in New York. About half the US cases are there, which makes the overall US situation seem slightly less bad. But over the coming weeks, according to Andrew Cuomo, it's all going to look like New York now looks. What's fascinating about Cuomo, though, is the way that he has approached this when you juxtapose it with Donald Trump. Because Shauna, where she's talking about the Trump's change of mind, she's dead right. It's extraordinary. There's a line attributed to John Maynard Keynes years ago where he U-turned on a thought that he had expressed. And he was criticized for it. And he said, well, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do? The extraordinary thing is Donald Trump has the capacity to change his mind when the mood changes, but the facts remain the same. Cuomo has done the exact opposite. Cuomo has been absolutely consistent from the start, and he has done two things that tend to be typical of brilliant leaders. The first is he's candy-coating nothing. He's telling people just how bad it is, and not only that, just how bad it will get. And secondly, he's keeping his sense of humor. It's a remarkable thing to see. If you look at yesterday's briefing, in which he actually talked about his own brother getting the disease and how frightened he was for his own brother's likely survival, he finished that statement by saying, I've sent him a book that I think will be vitally important in this time of crisis, which is How to Fish for Striped Bass. And he got a big laugh out of the room. That combination of the capacity to tell people the unvarnished truth and to do it with a sense of humour, few world leaders are comparing to him in that ability.
I'm wondering, Seana, finally, if the Swedish government is going to have to take a leaf from Galbraith's book. The government there has taken a much more relaxed approach to this whole crisis.
Yes, actually, I mean, this is a sort of an outlier situation because the Swedes are, you know, not comparable to the likes of Donald Trump or the United States, where they tend to be much more pragmatic. But there is no lockdown in Sweden. There are many, the schools are open. The only thing that there is advised is that there's no groups of no more than 50 people to congregate. Bars are open, restaurants are open. But there are fears. I think there was a letter signed by 2,000 Swedish doctors saying that the government needs to instigate a lockdown as soon as possible. The government has said so far that it would lead to economic disaster. Now, it has 4,435 cases and 180 deaths, which isn't a high proportion, but they're not doing vast testing. And essentially, the government said, we will intervene when we see it necessary, but right now, we just want our population to, quote, act like adults. Now, one of the theories is, of course, is that the Swedish healthcare system is excellent. They're one of the biggest spenders in Europe on public healthcare. But also from a familial life, there are very few people of several generations living together, unlike places in Italy, for example. So you have a lot of, well, this is what the foreign minister said, you have a lot of single people living on their own in Stockholm and the big cities, which means that the pace and the spread of the virus appears to have slowed down. But I mean, again, it's early stages for Sweden. There is huge warning signs that obviously things could evolve and exacerbate.
Okay, look, we'll leave it there. My thanks to you both. Seana Murray, Europe correspondent with Euronews, and also my thanks to Anton Savage, PR consultant.